It's the MPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. It's Tuesday, December 18th. Today on the podcast, we hear from the son of a victim of a mass shooting in Minneapolis. Also, the latest on the Cold Spring police officer killing, a plan to move sand around in Wabasha, and the group that pressed for construction of a new St. Croix River Bridge is keeping up the pressure. First, Minnesota schools are taking different approaches to how they discuss Friday's shootings in Connecticut. Some schools tell teachers not to talk about the incident unless students bring it up first. At Avalon School in St. Paul yesterday, teachers let students steer the conversation during the first class of the morning. Their discussions ranged from the pros and cons of gun control to school safety to mental illness. Junior Alex Kelly says it's important adults support their students.
They just need to listen to their kids and accept how their kids are feeling. Just that support is going to make more of a difference to your child than pushing your thoughts or ideas or this and that on them.
Many Minnesota schools made counselors available for students who needed to talk about the killings at Sandy Hook Elementary. A state lawmaker plans to introduce legislation during the upcoming legislative session that would allow teachers to carry guns in school. Here's Tom Scheck.
Republican Representative Tony Cornish of Good Thunder says he plans to introduce the legislation as a result of the shooting deaths of 26 children, teachers, and school administrators at an elementary school in Connecticut. Cornish says arming teachers and staff would be the best option to prevent additional attacks.
It's something that we have to face, that all the laws in the world sometimes just aren't going to work, and the cop can't be everywhere, and the best person to defend yourself is yourself.
Cornish's plan has been pushed by gun rights groups as a result of the tragedy in Connecticut, but it's already being dismissed by Governor Dayton.
I think that would be, you just increase the danger. I mean, to have weapons in classrooms, just to me defies common sense.
Gun control is likely to be a hot topic at the legislature this year. Some advocates want tougher background checks on those buying guns.
Tom Scheck at the state capitol. A psychologist at the U of M is advising that you tune out of the Connecticut school shooting story. Rochelle Moen says the extensive media coverage may be too much to bear for some. She says people who have experienced previous tragic losses are most vulnerable.
There's something called accumulative grief. And so what happens is that you grieve the loss of not only these current losses, but then all those that have come before. And so it really is a time that we start thinking about everything, and it can get overwhelming.
One Minnesota teen whose father was killed in the mass shooting at Accent Signage earlier this year is paying close attention to the next steps after the Sandy Hook school shooting. Sammy Rahamim says more needs to be done to keep guns out of schools and workplaces. His father, Ruvain Rahamim, owned Accent and was killed there in September. 17-year-old Sammy talked with our Tom Cran last night from New York, where he's visiting with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and other mass shooting survivors.
So when you heard this news on Friday about the Sandy Hook Elementary school shooting, what went through your mind?
Well, of course, it rehashed all the awful memories of the tragic shootings at Accent Signage in late September. But it prompted me to get up and take action. I had heard about a rally going down at Martin Luther King Jr. Park with an organization called Protect Minnesota to stand up for gun violence prevention and to work towards reducing the number of tragedies that we're seeing on truly a daily basis.
And tell me more about this Demand a Plan campaign. You and other mass shooting survivors are making some recommendations here. What are you recommending as you move forward as ways to prevent future shootings?
Well, some of the things that Mayor Michael Bloomberg had talked about during his press conferences are was the Fix Gun Checks Act, which is critical for closing the gaping loopholes that allow purchases of firearms without a background check. 40% of gun sales in the U.S. go through without any sort of a background check, and that's something that we just can't have in our country anymore. The other things that we talk about were establishing an enforceable assault weapon ban, because there's simply no place for that in our country. and there has they have new special technology that make them especially lethal with armor-piercing capabilities and high-frequency, high-capacity magazine clips that we are also trying to outlaw.
You met with the survivors today of some of the nation's recent mass shootings, and I'm wondering what sort of support network is there for those of you who have been through something like this that that only you really can know about those the emotional and psychological aspects of it?
Well, it was very touching meeting everyone this morning. People went around the room and shared their all-too-familiar stories, and the common word that was used was family, that, you know, it's unfortunate, and never in our wildest dreams would we want to be a part of this club, but it is what it is, and we're all in this together, and we vowed that this is not going to be the last time that we see each other.
Sammy Rahamim, how are you personally doing and your family? It hasn't even been 3 months since your father was killed in the Accent signage shooting at the business that he built up and owned. How are you coming to terms with it and dealing with it?
You know, me, my mom, and my two sisters are all handling this tragedy in our own ways, in ways that make it you know, easier for us to cope. My middle sister, Maya, is here with me in New York, and we're very much looking forward to taking on the fight for gun violence prevention. I think this is something that when the time is right, everyone who has been affected by this will come together and say that this is something we're passionate about. This is something that has torn our families apart, and we can't stand to see it happening to other families across the country.
Sammy Rahamim, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it, and telling us a bit more about your meeting with Mayor Michael Bloomberg and the Demand a Plan campaign.
Absolutely. No problem. Anytime.
Tom Cran with that interview on All Things Considered. Now the latest on another high-profile shooting. The FBI was in Cold Spring yesterday searching the Sauk River for evidence in the killing of Cold Spring police officer Tom Decker. He was shot and killed more than 2 weeks ago outside a nearby bar. Reporters Madeline Barron and Conrad Wilson spent the day in Cold Spring.
Investigators still haven't recovered a shotgun they believe killed Officer Tom Decker. Local divers searched the Sauk River in the days after the shooting. Now FBI divers have been brought in from New York to search the river about two blocks from Winner's Bar, where Officer Decker was killed last month. It's one of just four FBI dive teams in the country. FBI agent Jay Brun says the search was easier than expected because the water is clear.
We hope to be done by tomorrow.
The team also prepared to drop a robot equipped with cameras into the river. Brun says the team is using a grid system to ensure the entire river is covered in a thorough search. Investigators from the Stearns County Sheriff's Office were also on hand to assist.
As the search for evidence continues in Cold Spring, law enforcement officials in St. Paul gave the public the first update on the case in more than 2 weeks. Investigators now say they're looking for information on a van seen leaving the parking lot of the bar shortly after Decker was shot. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Superintendent Wade Setter describes the vehicle as a black van or minivan with a loud muffler. Setter says witnesses saw the van leave the parking lot and drive west on Main Street away from the Sauk River.
It was in the immediate area at the time of the shooting, and seen leaving the parking lot and then driving westbound on Main Street through the town of Cold Spring.
Setter asked the public for help.
We want someone to come forward. Any piece of information that they have, no matter how menial it may seem to them, is critical as we go through the many, many leads we've amassed over the past 2.5 weeks. And those leads may become relevant as we assemble this investigation.
The nonprofit organization Spotlight on Crime announced it is offering a reward of up to $100,000 for information leading to an arrest and conviction in the case.
Police originally thought they found the killer just a few feet from the murder scene in an apartment above the bar. Police say Officer Decker was there to check on a possibly suicidal man who lives there. When Decker got out of the car, police say he was shot twice and died. The man who lived above the bar, Ryan Larson, was arrested that night. He was released 5 days later when prosecutors said they didn't have enough evidence to file charges. During an interview with NPR News on Friday, Larson said he last spoke to police earlier in the week. At the time, they told him that he would be cleared in a matter of days. Larson says he did not kill Decker. He says life has dramatically changed since police arrested him.
My apartment is inhabitable due to their searches. Basically, they knocked on the walls, they tore up the floors, and of course, working at the bar in Cold Spring or Sartell, for my safety, this probably is a good idea.
More than 2 weeks after Officer Decker's murder, police still have no weapon and no suspects in custody. From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Conrad Wilson.
And I'm Madeline Barron in Cold Spring.
And this is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Trucks carrying silica sand may soon start rumbling through the southeastern Minnesota town of Wabasha. Last night, the city council decided not to require Canada-based Superior Sand Systems to go through an environmental review, a move Elizabeth Baer says disappointed dozens of residents and environmentalists.
The council had to consider the environmental review for the proposed silica sand storage and loading facility after residents petitioned the state's Environmental Quality Board. Superior Sand Systems wants to build the facility along the Canadian Pacific Tracks on the northwest side of this Mississippi River town. Petitioners had hoped the environmental review would identify the proposed facility's health, traffic, and safety concerns. The petitioners formed a group called Friends of Wabasha. Craig Falcom is one of the group's leaders.
Our common belief is that insufficient analysis has been done regarding the trucking through the city and regarding the loading facility itself. The city has completed a checklist for the conditional use permit, but we believe an operation of this magnitude cannot be adequately addressed through a checklist.
Falcom and Friends of Wabasha wanted a more in-depth environmental review, known as the Environmental Assessment Worksheet, or EAW. Falcom told the council he believes the small city of 2,500 is ill-equipped to handle the process on its own.
We believe that the EAW, done by consultants, will provide the city with an established format and a systematic review by a team of professionals to determine what the risks of this operation are. There are too many residences in the nearby area, as well as a prominent industry and a clinic and a hospital, to allow this operation to proceed without a thorough investigation.
Council members voted 5-1 against requiring the environmental review. Instead, the council deferred to the city's planning board to implement guidelines for the proposed project. Superior Sand is asking for permission to move as many as 300 trucks of sand through the facility each day. It also proposes to operate 7 days a week. Most of the sand would be hauled from Wisconsin, either to North Dakota or south to Texas. There, energy and mining companies would use the sand to extract oil and natural gas from the ground in a process known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Paul Van Eyl is a lands acquisition manager with Superior Sand Systems. He says the company is working with the city's planning board to address many of the residents' concerns through the standard permitting process.
You know, the citizens, you know, obviously they're concerned, and frac sand's a very controversial issue. And I do believe that we've addressed these issues, you know, through the CUP process. We've spent so many hours with the city trying to, you know, address issues of truck traffic and et cetera.
At the meeting, Superior Sand's Van Eyl also argued the city was out of its jurisdiction in requiring an environmental review. He cited a congressional act that prohibits states from regulating the railroads, which Superior Sand wants to use to transport sand. Council members and the city attorney agreed. Councilmember Catherine Gallenberger said the requirements in the regular permitting process should be enough to thoroughly assess the project. And she said potential litigation from Superior Sand on the issue of jurisdiction over the railroads could cost the city a lot of money.
And where is that money going to come from? Does that mean we have to raise the taxes again next year to the degree that we raised them this year so we can pay for this possible, you know, fight that we may have? Or should we just continue on the course that we have set in our policies, which hopefully, you know, maybe we're going to be wrong, but hopefully will protect us.
The city's planning board will vote on the proposed facility's conditional use permit today. If approved, Superior Sand Systems expects to begin operating as early as Thursday.
That's Liz Baer in Wabasha. In the East Metro, preparations for a new St. Croix Bridge are moving forward, and the group that successfully lobbied for the bridge project isn't stopping its work. The group has a long list of backers who have contributed tens of thousands of dollars to the effort. Jess Mador says they include cities and counties on both sides of the river and some of the most prominent business leaders and companies in the St. Croix River Valley.
The Coalition for the St. Croix River Crossing was formed 2 years ago. The group's mission was simple: to succeed where past efforts have failed and clear the way for a new highway bridge between Minnesota and Wisconsin. Earlier this year, supporters of a new river crossing got their wish. President Obama signed legislation allowing the project, which will cost between $580 and $676 million, to move forward. Coalition Director Larry Dowell says after decades of failed efforts, this time the lobbying paid off.
We had a job to do, and that was to garner the state, federal approvals, including an act of Congress and the president's signature, and ensuring that the resources in both Minnesota and Wisconsin were available to make the project possible.
Despite the high-profile work of the coalition, it's difficult to find out who its members and contributors are. Dowell wouldn't release a list of the 82 donors and its members. The coalition reports raising and spending $300,000 since its founding. Dowell says 85% of that came from individuals or businesses. The rest was from the public sector. Tax forms show members of the organization also pay annual dues of $100. NPR News confirmed that one of the private sector contributors was Lakeview Hospital in Stillwater. Hospital President Kurt Geisler sits on the coalition's board. Geisler says the hospital donated several thousand dollars last year to help push for a new bridge. The existing 80-year-old Stillwater Lift Bridge, he says, is not reliable.
So when the bridge is closed, we actually have to put another ambulance crew in western Wisconsin 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Geisler says that cost the hospital about $1,200 a day. Geisler's hoping the project will improve emergency response time. His ambulances serve several hundred miles between North St. Paul, Scandia, Somerset, and Interstate 94 on both sides of the river.
It's difficult in a rural setting to get it sometimes for like a multiple car accident to get enough responders.
Another contributor to the coalition was Anderson Windows. Spokesperson Lori Bauer says the company donated $20,000 to the coalition because half of its 3,000 employees in Bayport and Oak Park Heights commute across the St. Croix every day.
It is about travel time, but it's more about safety. We have employees that roll their windows down and take off their seatbelts because they're afraid that that bridge may go down. And it does come down to, it adds at least a half an hour of time on people's travels if they have to go around the bridge.
Cities and towns along the river in Wisconsin and Minnesota also gave money. Some opponents of the bridge and several Stillwater Council members weren't happy about taxpayer funds going to a group whose bylaws, contributors, and expenditures are not available to the public. Last fall, such objections led to the coalition giving back $80,000 to the city of Stillwater after the state auditor found Stillwater's donation violated state tax laws. The city has since legally contributed $10,000 to the group. St. Croix County in Wisconsin contributed $20,000 to the coalition. Administrator Patrick Thompson says the county has a lot to gain from a new bridge in terms of future development and less congestion. He says there's still a need to support the group.
It's a complicated project. We have two states that are involved and two Department of Transportations, both MDOT and WISDOT. There needs to be coordination at a pretty high level, and the coalition is fulfilling that role.
Coalition officials say the group will continue fundraising and advocating for the new bridge until all necessary permits are in and construction is underway. Construction is expected to begin in spring 2013, and it'll take approximately 3 years to complete. According to the coalition's IRS tax forms, if and when the group disbands, any remaining assets will be given to the state to pay for maintenance of the Stillwater Lift Bridge. That bridge will become a bike and pedestrian bridge once the new St. Croix span is complete.
Jess Mador on the NPR News Update. A proposal to connect Minneapolis to Brooklyn Park with light rail trains gets a crucial vote in Golden Valley tonight. Laura Ewan reports.
The city is considering a reversal of its earlier opposition to the so-called Bottineau line. Golden Valley residents who live near the proposed alignment have complained that the trains would spoil sacred green space in this woodsy inner ring suburb. Councilmember Joni Clausen says she understands those concerns.
I can feel their pain. I've had a lot of the same questions. We build up our open space. What are we going to leave for our children and grandchildren? But I think without having everything out in front of us, maybe it's too premature to make the final decision.
Clausen voted against the route last summer, but says she'll probably vote tonight in support of a new resolution that's likely to pass. It stops short of endorsing the alignment and calls for further study. If regional planners have their way, the Bottineau line would be the Twin Cities' fourth light rail spoke.
That's our Laura Ewan. Two engineering and design firms could win contracts for the planned Southwest LRT. A Met Council committee has voted to recommend North Carolina-based Kim Lee Horn for the eastern half of the line and California-based AECOM for the western half. The full Met Council votes this week on whether to grant the contracts. The Met Council's Mark Furman says the firm's proposals were creative.
They were very carefully thought proposals, responding directly to our requests for looking at the key issues in the east, freight rail in the west, what kind of bridge structures we need to look at, and the alignment in Eden Prairie.
A third contract will be issued for an engineering firm to review the line's design. The Minnesota Gambling Control Board has approved two more manufacturers to provide bars and restaurants with electronic pull tabs. Supporters say having a single vendor for the last 3 months has hampered growth of the games earmarked to pay for the new Viking Stadium. The Metropolitan Airport's commission has also voted to allow the games at six bars inside of the Twin Cities Airport. Pat Hogan is an airport spokesman.
You know, we expect that if the test is successful, we'll have a lot more concessionaires in the future who will also want to introduce the electronic pull tabs at their venues. So we'll see how it goes, and hopefully it'll be very successful here.
So far, 88 locations have the electronic pull tabs. Minneapolis officials expect a flood of applications for new firefighter positions. The fire department received more than 1,500 applications the last time it put out a call for new recruits 6 years ago. Fire Chief John Friedel says more than 10% of his current firefighters will be eligible to retire next year. And he says the department needs a pool of new recruits for the coming years.
The silver tsunami that the mayor likes to refer to is certainly going to come to this department. It's going to be very, very important that this department maintain a distinct level of diversity that certainly mirrors the community that it serves.
Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback says next year's budget includes more than $1 million to hire 15 new firefighter cadets who are already being trained and will be ready to start work in the spring. I'm Phil Picardi. I'm ready to go back to work tomorrow on the Wednesday edition of the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule.